It's time to sit back, relax, and listen to Conversations with Joan. Conversations with Joan will inspire, motivate, and empower you. Live your best life now. Listen, learn, think, and decide. And now, here's your host, Joan Herman.
Welcome to Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life's Conversations with Joan. I'm Joan Herman. Thanks for tuning in. Conversations with Joan focuses on topics that are important to your life, from health and wellness to professional development to personal well-being. Changemakers join me to share their insights, tips, and strategies so you can thrive and live your best life now. Thank you for taking time for yourself, and thank you for letting us be a part of your life. Now, let's start talking. Society gives us very clear messages about what we're supposed to look like, and when we don't conform, we're left feeling ashamed, insecure, angry, and frustrated. Today's guest, Cara Richardson-Whiteley, works to raise awareness about the importance of embracing diverse body types. At more than 300 pounds, Cara climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, bringing her from the depth of self-doubt to the top of the world. Her difficult trek speaks to every woman who has struggled with negative self-image. Cara joins us today to talk about her journey of intense passion, endurance, and self-acceptance. Cara is the founder and CEO of The Gorgeous Agency, an outdoor adventurer and influencer, and author of the book, Gorge, My Journey Up Kilimanjaro at 300 Pounds. Her story is soon to be a movie produced by and starring This Is Us actress Chrissy Metz. Welcome, Cara. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, John.
So, Cara, you have such a fascinating story, and you are doing really important work. So how did you get started? I want to talk about the mountain climbing aspect first. How did you get interested in mountain climbing?
Well, as somebody who's lived in a larger body for the majority of my life, I first started struggling with weight when I was 9 years old, and then it really amplified when I was 12. And, you know, I really struggled with binge eating disorder, and what that is, the most common eating disorder out there, but often the least talked about. And so when I was going through traumas, which I did at a very early age, I would stuff down those feelings with food. And unlike bulimia, it wasn't like I purged afterwards. So the weight really kept on going and going. And the more that I ate for feelings and pushing away feelings, the more I pushed away also joy from my life. Whenever you have any kind of coping mechanism, whether it's food or drugs, alcohol, gambling, it's about pushing away, right? And what I noticed was I was about to turn 30, and I got this adventure travel catalog in the mail, and I thought to myself, well, I'll do that when I lose weight. And I realized how much of a conversation that was in my head that I didn't feel worthy until I dropped pounds, right? Mm-hmm. And I realized I said that about everything. I'll buy myself a whole new wardrobe when I lose weight. I'll go to the doctors when I lose weight. And everything was put behind this goal of changing my body. But when I looked at this adventure travel catalog and I was about to turn 30, I realized, you know, I'm not getting any younger. And so when am I going to start doing these things? And how can I be a hiker girl when I, at the time, do not fit the mold of the way that hikers were shown in marketing materials, in these glossy images? How could I be part of that world in the body that I was in? And so that meant, you know, going to the trail. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey. Sorry, I was living in New Jersey at the time. I grew up in Vermont, Canada. And there were a lot of flat trails. And so how could I just start? And that meant, you know, taking my first steps around, Watchung Reservation and this tiny little 20-minute trail that probably a preschool could do as a field trip. But for me, it was these first steps into the woods. And what I realized was that, you know, being in the woods, instead of pushing away all that negative stuff, it was all about pulling it in. And so when you hike on a trail, you never know what's coming, right? You might know the trail. You might have studied it before or glanced at the trailhead, but you don't know if it's been rainy, so it's super muddy or a little bit icy, or maybe you'll even see a bear. But you go ahead step after step, pulling in all the emotions of fear and excitement and terror and joy. Because sometimes, you know, on a trail, I've seen the most beautiful and wonderful and rewarding things that I've seen in my life. And so those steps toward, you know, on flat New Jersey trails were the first steps of me really recognizing how powerful the outdoors and hiking can be for me.
Well, you just described, I'm someone who has also struggled with weight most of my life. I'm a yo-yo dieter. So I do understand that mentality of I'll do this when I lose weight. You talked about starting off on the trails and just getting out there and doing it. And that really is the key to just do something. I always say Nike had the best slogan, just do it. But how did you go from walking those flat trails to climbing? How do you make that leap?
Well, it's definitely not overnight. And, you know, for anyone who has Kilimanjaro or something similar, whether it's Everest Base Camp, I'm not talking about the tippy top of Everest, but or Machu Picchu or something higher on their life list or bucket list, you really want to allocate like a good 4 to 6 months to just train in that direction and to seek professionals or guidance to get you to that place. But for me, it was, you know, once I started doing a 20-minute trail, well, I really liked it. And I found movement that brought me joy and interest. And then I wanted to do more. And I wanted to do more. And every molehill led to a mountain. Every mountain led to a taller mountain or a longer trail. I mean, I found that just this past weekend, you know, I've been really, really tied up with work. We've got it. I'm speaking at Transform, which is a huge HR conference in March. And I've got a number of really big things coming down the pipeline. And I realized I hadn't been out in a bit. And so I took a little walk with my family. Maybe it was a mile and a half. Maybe it was two. And I'm like, oh, right. I've missed this. And so it has this, for me, because I find it joyful, it has this pull to do more, you know, to just keep moving forward, you know, just keep, you know, what's the next step from here?
What did people say to you when you told them that you were going to do this climb?
Yeah, that's a great question, because a lot of people thought that it was crazy because I was in a larger body, but I knew that I was doing the training. I was, you know, working out, you know, my stamina, my spirit, my strength, those three things, you know. So stamina meant a lot of hiking. Strength meant that I was doing a lot of strength training so that my core and the muscles around my knees were strong. But spirit, I spent a lot of time, you know, doing yoga, and my favorite part was Savasana, where, you know, you had a moment to just be in your own mind and meditate. And I loved that opportunity to just believe for a second and see myself at the top of the mountain. Because when you ask the question of what do people say, well, a lot of people couldn't believe that that was something that I was doing it. And they're like, good luck, you know. There was a lot of judgment. There was a lot of fear that I wasn't going to survive this trek to 19,343 feet. But I knew that I had put in the work. I had taken the steps and I was ready. I wouldn't have gone if I wasn't.
Where do you think that stigma comes from?
Oh my gosh. There are so many places that fat phobia has been rooted in, and judgment, and so much of it is this, you know, the patriarchy. Actually, there's a lot of roots where a lot of fat phobia is based in actual racism. I think the fear of the black body, I just posted something on LinkedIn about that link between racism and fat phobia. And it's really important to start to see about why do we judge people's bodies, particularly women's hold a standard of slender ideal versus just accepting people as they are. And, you know, fat bodies have been around throughout time, and so much of people's bodies are not what how they eat or move. A lot of it is just genetics or health conditions as well. So it's really important to not really judge the narrative of someone's body just by looking at them.
Well, and if you look at what you've accomplished, you are in really good physical shape. And yet, as you were describing, people just didn't see that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that, I mean, that's what, you know, the work we do at the Gorgeous Agency is not only, it basically has two tracks. One is in internal to help companies navigate the conversation about body inclusion and how to have difficult conversations about weight stigma in the workplace. Because there have been so many narratives that have been created for us that you have to be in a skinny body to be have a healthy body, when in fact there's a lot of research that doesn't necessarily say that's true. You know, what you want to encourage are health behaviors like getting enough sleep, moving your body, eating nutrient-dense foods. But for someone like me, I have a condition called lipedema, and lipedema is a fat tissue disorder. And I didn't even know this when I wrote Gorge that, you know, I carry the majority of my weight between my navel and my knees, and come to find out, like, gosh, that's actually a fat disorder that, that, you know, if I want to remove that tissue, it takes surgery to do that. It's not going to leave on its own. There's no amount of diet or exercise that would even change that. And then same goes with, you know, if somebody drops a large amount of pounds, well, they might be going through something that has nothing to do with, you know, how many carbs they're eating or something like that. I mean, I have a friend who is going through some really challenging personal stuff. I mean, really traumatic. And because she was living on adrenaline, she just started losing weight. And instead of people talking to her about what was really important and what she was going through, they would just automatically say, oh my gosh, she looks so amazing. And same goes with a friend of mine who ultimately died of cancer. You know, they didn't know she had cancer, and yet the only thing they could think of was to comment on her body. And so it goes both ways in building that awareness about body inclusion in the workplace, and also for retailers to know that this plus size community is absolutely underserved and is a huge opportunity for people to explore how to reach and connect with this audience. It's so, so important.
I have to say, for the first time in my life, it does appear that we're seeing a little bit more about body diversity and inclusion. And I think that we're starting to head in the right direction. But there's a lot that we still need to be doing. From what you've learned and the work that you're doing, what can society do differently to foster inclusion?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think that there's a number of things. I mean, we work primarily with corporations to help them, to guide them and navigate them through body inclusion efforts, because I believe very strongly that corporations have such power mm-hmm. over the grand messaging. So that's one thing that we do at the Gorgeous Agency is to help lead those conversations. But on the whole, I mean, you want to talk to, you want to challenge your notions about what, you know, how you judge folks that you see and the narrative that you assign when you see a body. It's time to start questioning that. And so the work we do in workplaces is to help guide and combat that unconscious bias. It's really important to start having these conversations now about how you're seeing and assigning attributes to people because of their body size, because studies have shown that negative thoughts and feelings about other marginalized groups have actually gone down, but negative thoughts and feelings about people in larger bodies have actually increased recently. And so it's time to start thinking about how we treat and how we consider people in larger bodies as different and other, and do we hold negative thoughts and feelings about that? And what do you do with them, right? It's important to start evaluating that in your own mind, challenging things that you're seeing on TV, like, is this real? Especially in the world of AI, I mean, this is a whole new conversation to be had about how are people showing up in virtual realities and things like that. So it's important to start thinking about how this all affects the world around us and how we're thinking about bodies.
The book is Gorge, My Journey Up Kilimanjaro at 300 Pounds. Cora, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your work?
You want to go to thegorgeousagency.com, and there you'll see information about the work that we've done. We have a really great resource, again, for people who want to start having this conversation or thinking deeper about body inclusion. There is a body inclusion library there. If you look at media and resources, you'll also see some information about the work we've done, including a case study that we just released for our work with Peloton. And then you'll see a number of testimonials and really how to reach out to us and work with us as well.
Cora, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much, Joan, and thanks, listeners, for tuning in.
This is Conversations with Joan. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Do you feel lost on your journey to health and happiness? Then let us guide you on your path, personalized actions towards health. Your path is a series of choices you act on every day. We guide you on a personalized journey of dietary, exercise, genetic, supplement, and lifestyle choices that lead you to optimal health and happiness. Often taking the road less traveled leads to liberation. Your path is personal. Your journey, like you, is unique. Take action today. Head to bestpathforme.com. Again, that's bestpathforme.com.
Big dreams require faith. Sometimes it's hard to keep dreaming if we can't envision how to achieve it. Hi, I'm Allison Ayati. I'm a musician, sound practitioner, and the creator of The Sound Life, an app for stress reduction through relaxation and sound meditation. Here's my recipe for achieving your dreams. Think about your tasks in three different pools. One, plan for today and tomorrow. Two, envision your future. Three, dream big. Planning is how you take care of your responsibilities. Envisioning is how you think about what you want. It includes what your dream looks like, what you are doing, who else is involved, what you need to succeed. Dreaming big is the pie in the sky that might seem unattainable. Give yourself permission to dream without editing your thoughts. You're only dreaming, so dream, but live your vision. You can live your vision by setting goals and creating a plan of action to achieve them. Sound meditation can calm your mind, making it easier to think clearly about what you want to accomplish and how and when you can do it. I'm Allison Ayati, and I want to help you live your dreams. To learn more, go to livingthesoundlife.com. The Sound Life is not a replacement for medical or psychological intervention.
Do you have a product or service that can change someone's life? Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life is teaming up with reputable professionals that we can recommend to our hundreds of thousands of followers. People come to us for life-changing resources, and we'd like to tell them about you. Our professional directory is a digital destination that will showcase your services, notable success, and industry recognition. To learn how you can elevate your business and ranking by being part of the Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life directory, visit cyacyl.com/profiles. It's time for To Your Health. Joining us today to talk about sexual health is Dr. Christopher Awad, a family medicine physician and the medical director for the LGBTQ+ Health and Wellness Center at Bergen-Newbridge Medical Center. Welcome, doctor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Doctor, when we say sexual health, what does that encompass?
So sexual health can encompass a lot of things. It can encompass our physical health related to sexual issues, as well as our mental health. It's an area that is really neglected historically within medical care, and that's something that we're really working to change here.
Why do you believe it's been neglected?
I think that there are multiple reasons. I think there's a lot of stigma attached to sexual health in general. I think that as healthcare providers, we're not always trained to have these important conversations to really delve into things, especially when a patient's lived experience may be different than our own. We really only have our own frame of reference. And so sort of looking out past that, extending past that, and being able to have a conversation that's comfortable for both individuals to really get at and assess someone's individual risk factors, individual needs within sexual health.
If this is something a doctor doesn't bring up, do you advise a patient to do so?
Absolutely. I think that really the only way to move the needle is to ask for these conversations, to bring up specific concerns. And as with many other areas of medicine, when faced with the question, most healthcare providers will make it their duty to continue learning and continue expanding their skill set based on the request of their patients.
So we tend to talk to our doctors when we have a problem with something, when there's some type of a symptom. But what should we be bringing up in a routine conversation?
I think asking questions about what types of routine testing might be indicated for someone. Should I have screening? There are many Americans who have never had even a routine HIV test once in their life. We have lots of guidelines that exist for routine testing for anyone between ages 13 and 64 to at least have one HIV test in their lifetime. And we know that oftentimes these mandates are sort of ignored and we sort of breeze right past them, assuming that someone might not have risk. And that can leave a lot of people at risk for, delayed diagnosis or presentation when, specifically with HIV, when their, illness is further advanced than it had to be, without appropriate screening.
So a test like that would not be part of a regular routine panel in a physical?
So ideally it should be, but we know that the testing numbers are much lower than they should be. There are a lot of efforts now to improve, routine screening for patients who are asymptomatic, for HIV, for viral hepatitis like hepatitis B, hepatitis C. But we know that those numbers are very low, and we're, really working to drive that that standard of care upward.
And what are some of the biggest problems that you see patients presenting with?
Typically, the problems that I see patients presenting with are concerns about, potential exposure to a sexually transmitted infection, or potentially, a lesion that they noticed in a more sensitive area of the body that they might feel a little less comfortable presenting to their own primary care doctor with. And so, being able to provide an environment where someone could come in and ask a question, knowing that there's, not going to be that judgment, that there's not going to be any sort of discrimination in our clinic is a really important thing for us to offer.
Are sexually transmitted diseases on the rise?
Definitely. I'm seeing much higher numbers now than I've seen in most of my career, and specifically higher numbers of syphilis. We're really trying to take a look at how we can, combat that. How do we prevent new infections, and how do we engage people in care for the testing that they need and rapidly treat and prevent further infections or complications down the road?
And what can we do to promote sexual health?
Absolutely. So, routine testing first and foremost, consistent and appropriate condom use is also important. And then other interventions like pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. So that is when we use a medication for someone who has risk of HIV infection, either through pill form or an injectable form, to decrease the risk of HIV drastically. Anyone who is HIV, who is living with HIV, maintaining them in care is another important prevention method. So that would be treatment as prevention to make sure that viral load is controlled and kept undetectable so that it will be untransmittable and can't be spread from person to person. Another newer intervention is what's called DoxyPEP. So that's the use of an antibiotic, doxycycline, for post-exposure prophylaxis, so to prevent an infection after a potential exposure to an STI. And we have newer data on that that shows that it can decrease the risk of gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis by about 60%, by about a two-thirds drop in infections if taken within 24 hours to 72 hours after a potential exposure.
And if our listeners would like to learn more about this topic or Dr. Wadd and his work, you can visit newbridgehealth.org. Thank you for joining us. I hope you found the show informative. At Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life, we believe that knowledge is power. Take what you've learned, apply it, and live your best life now. Remember that the information provided is the opinion of our guest and should never replace the advice of a professional who knows your personal situation. If you'd like more information, visit our website, CYACYL.com. That stands for Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life. While on our site, listen to past shows on demand, read the digital magazine, sign up for our mailing list, and be sure to follow the show on social media. Until next time, this is Joan Herman. Thanks for tuning in.
The preceding pre-recorded program sponsored by Maximilian Communications.